The following is a record of Lola Clyde practicing her talk on Carol Ryrie Brink's novel, Snow in the River. Soon after this book was published, Lola Clyde gave a talk much like this to many local groups.
It was her efforts, or maybe it was the doctor's beautiful daughters, because right across the street from the Presbyterian Church lived Dr. Hedricks and his family. And Abigail, the elder daughter, was ravishingly beautiful, with beautiful dark curling hair and great velvety dark brown eyes. She was just home from Portland finishing school. And the second girl, Connie, was more blonde, but she was generous, now was plainer and more blonde, but she was generous, good-natured, and an incessant chatterbox. Now the social life of the community centered around the church. There was choir practice and young people's meetings and prayer meetings and basket suppers, and always Angus seeing Abby home. Now good-natured Willie fell in love with good-natured Connie, but Connie had eyes only for the handsome, dark Douglas. After a very proper courtship, Abby and Angus are married. Abby didn't wear a veil, but she had a beautiful white mull wedding dress all shirred around the waist, with cascades of lace falling from the sleeves. Her hair was piled high on her head and a white rose tucked behind her ear. She carried a bouquet of white roses that had been gathered from all the late fall gardens of the entire town. And the wedding breakfast, chicken pie and homemade ice cream and bridal cake. And all the wedding's presents were set out in the front bedroom. And there were such things as vinegar cruets, jug and pitcher sets, a splasher set, a caster set, antimacassars, framed mottos saying, God bless our home. And then the loveliest, most ornate gift the old doctor could find in all of opportunity to give his little girl, a silver-plated tankard set with two enormous goblets as big as the communion cups at church. And on each one of these, he had caused to be engraved, first in large writing and then in smaller, from Papa to Abby. From Papa to Abby. So Abby and Angus were married and went to live in Honeymoon House. Now on the west side of Hayes Street, between 3rd Street and 4th Street, are two identical cottages. They've had their faces lifted many times since the 1890s, but Carol calls these twin pink houses, and much happiness is centered there. And a few months after the wedding, Willie makes an overnight trip to Pullman and comes home and confesses to his brothers, "Well, I have got to get married." "My, you're a fast worker," said Douglas. "Oh, it isn't what you think," said Willie, "but I met a poor little lassie over at Pullman, and she's pregnant. It isn't any of her fault. She got it in her tea, or she was raped. But she says she'll just kill herself if I don't marry her, so I promised go to Pullman and offer her some money," said Angus, "but not too much." Douglas goes, and then he soon has some Pullman problems of his own on his hands. The young girl spurns the gold. No, indeed, she's in love with Willie, and she intends to marry him, and she does, and they move to Opportunity on the other side of the track. They move to live in Opportunity on the other side of the tracks. But Douglas soon has Pullman problems of his own. He is called upon to rescue the most ravishingly beautiful damsel in distress that you ever laid eyes on. He had to save her from the wretched poverty and cruelty of her stepfather, and then from a fate worse than death at the hands of a married reprobate named named Buck Claiborne is so very beautiful, and Douglas marries her and takes her to Spokane and buys her the most beautiful wardrobe that money could find, and they come back to live in the other little pink cottage. Well, many of the old-timers still remember Mamie. Homer says, oh, she was so beautiful, she would just make a bishop forget his prayers. And Dr. Hedrick said, my, I feel sorry for Reverend Horner over there at the church. He just can't get any attention anymore. The women are all so busy trying to look at that Mamie's new hats, and the men are all so busy trying to get a look at her ankles that he can't get any attention. And his placid wife said, well, how would you know, doctor? You never go to church. But when the businessmen heard this sally, they just laughed. And when Mamie heard it, she just laughed the hardest of all. And then one night, there comes a rap at Douglas's door. And then toward the last of December, about a year later, there comes a knock on Douglas's door, and it's Angus. Would you go and get the doctor? Our baby is about to be born. The doctor and his wife come, and after a long, difficult labor, a wee, weak lassie is ushered into the world. Oh, I'm afraid she's stillborn, cried the grandma. Oh, no child of mine is going to be stillborn, cried the old doctor. And he lowered his bearded face to the little mouth and blew the breath of life into it. And Carol says, when I remember that I was not a spectator at that, but the principal actor. And Carol says, I've heard this story so many times that I seem more like a spectator at that event than the principal actor. And Abby said, oh, I wanted to be born on Christmas Day, so we'll call her Christine. And of course, we remember a little girl that was born close to Christmas, who's called Carol. Well, about this time, Douglas asks Willie, whatever happened to the baby they'd been expecting? And Willie had to admit that it was just a hoax, that Alma had been so in love with him that it was just a hoax to catch him. But they are expecting a baby, but this one's just going to be all his own. And then follows four happy, busy years. Douglas has the Midas touch, gold. Douglas has the Midas touch, gold. And Angus is elected mayor of the town. Angus is elected mayor of the town, and he works always for the good of the community. He is stated clerk of the Presbyterian Church. And it is he who carries the pledge cards through the snow and the wet to get the old building remodeled, to have the old building enlarged and remodeled. He catches a very bad bronchial cough that he doesn't seem quite able to shake off. And about this time he started in making the little church calendars. He had a sort of a free, he would do them in his dainty, delicate little Scotch handwriting and have them, and then hectograph them. He had a sort of freehand art. He had some skill at freehand art, and sometimes he'd draw a picture of the old church on the outside or a picture of the new church as he would like it to look. Sometimes it was an old man and a little child walking hand in hand, or an open Bible with a candle beside it, or a bough of apple blossoms. And the congregation was not without appreciation, for years later, old trunks of keepsakes yielded entire files of Angus's homemade calendars. Then Douglas, who is a most acute, astute businessman, gets a wonderful offer to go to Manitou City, and which is now booming. The mines are coming in, and there's money being made, and there are fortunes being made overnight. Douglas and Mamie move. So Douglas and Mamie leave the little pink cottage. And Carol says, all the lovely, extravagant furniture was sold. Grandma Hedrick bought much of the lovely Haviland, and some of those pieces have come down to me. Fragile. China, fragile as it is, far outlives human beings. And I bought some of the Haviland from her when she left, when they closed the Watkins house, and it's here for you to look. Well, Angus has prospered too, and he's been very careful and thrifty with his money. He's made very fine investments and taken out a lot of life insurance for the protection of his family. But then one day he says to Abby, I want to plan a trip to Scotland. I want the folks to see my two bonny lassies. You get some new clothes and we'll go. And then one day Dr. Hedrick lays down the stethoscope on his desk and says, you're not going to Scotland, man. You're going to go. Scotland is a cold, damp climate. You're going to go someplace where there's sunlight and warmth. And Angus said, oh, but I've promised Eddie, and the old folks have made a little high chair for Christine. High chair be damned, said the old doctor. You've got to go where there's warmth. And I'll tell Abby. You've got to go where there's sunlight. And I'll tell Abby. No, I'll tell Abby, said Angus. And he remembering the blood on his handkerchief that morning that had sent him to consult with the doctor. Angus's world reeled about him. In a dream, he walked out into the cold November sunlight, and through his head rang the words that he knew so well. Our Father who art in heaven, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. So Christine stays with the grandparents while the folks go to Arizona. And it's spring, and they come home, and Angus is well, is miraculously well. And Abby plays the piano gaily and sings and laughs. And every night there's company for dinner. But always at that table sits a specter. And then it's fall again, and Angus must go back to Arizona. This time, Abby and Christine both stay. And Angus got as far as San Francisco, and in a hotel room, alone, he dies. They send for Douglas, and Mamie's sick in bed with La Grippe. Oh, how can Angus do such a thing? How can Angus do such a thing, right when we were having such a good time? Of course, I can't go. Douglas went, and they buried Angus from the little church he had worked so hard to build. The entire town came, people from every denomination and every walk of life. Angus had been loved. And Douglas, looking on the white, still face of his brother, thought how little he had changed from when he had last saw him. And then it occurred to him that death had been sitting there for many years, unnoticed by the rest. And Douglas checks Abby's financial standing and said, oh, Abby, Angus made wonderful investments for you and left you much life insurance. You'll be a very wealthy widow, but please, don't, through lonesomeness and boredom, don't rush into a second marriage. And then the dark eyes flashed. Oh, how could you, Douglas? My heart is in the grave with Angus. If it weren't for Christine, I'd kill myself and you could bury me too. My life is ended. Forgive me, said Douglas. And he went back to Manitou City. And there on the platform is Mamie, all well and bubbling over with excitement. There is Amy in a new fur neck piece and a lovely little fur hat and just bubbling over with excitement. Oh, Douglas, You know that beautiful new hotel that they're building? Well, they're having the grand opening tonight. And it's the loveliest thing, a beautiful fountain in the lobby, flowers of all kinds, and the most exotic birds in gilded cages. And, surprise, a voice from the past. I ran onto Buck Claiborne the other day, and he's bought tickets for all three of us for that gala opening banquet tonight. They went, and the fountain tinkled, and the exotic birds sang, and the gas lights made such a wonderful spluttering noise in their chandeliers amid the myriad rainbow-hued prisms. Douglas is called to the telephone, and there is a deafening explosion, and there is a deafening roar, and the flames and the smoke fill the entire hotel. The gas lines have exploded. He fights his way through the smoke and flames in search of his wife. He's trampled down by the panic-stricken people. 6 weeks later, he woke up in a hospital, swathed in bandages, and he can't see, and he can't see. He asks for Mamie, evasive answers. Willie comes, checks, and says, well, he may as well know the truth. Mamie checked out. Mamie's safe. She checked out. She escaped through the back door the night of the explosion. And she and Buck Claiborne checked out of the apartment half an hour later. They caught the midnight train for Chicago, and no one has seen them since. Douglas turned his face to the wall. But he didn't die, and he didn't lose his eyesight, and he made a wise decision just to spend the rest of his life making money. Back in Opportunity, Connie has been very ill. She has driven away all her suitors with her sharp tongue, and her father won't allow her to become a nurse. So, added to the rescue, she sells some of her investments. She takes Connie and little Christine to San Francisco for a whole season of restaurant suppers and theater parties. And here Abby meets a smooth-talking young man named Jack Yancey and his sister, Miss Chadwick. As soon as Jack discovers that it's the young widow who has the money, he transfers his affections. They're called home from Frisco by the death of Dr. Hedrick. He died quickly with a heart attack and left his widow nothing but the big house and its furnishings. The doctor had always been a very poor collector. And shortly after this, Douglas gets a letter from Connie. Oh, Douglas, do come down. Abby is about to make a terrible mistake. Now, don't say a word, Douglas, Abby says. I know what I'm doing. Everybody is so against me marrying Jack Yancey, but I intend to do it anyway. And I want you to get me my part of Angus's money. You can invest Christine's for her in case anything should happen. And that in case troubled Douglas because he thought maybe she had some doubts. Abby built a new home. It stood on Van Buren Street where Kelly Klein's house now stands. And a lot of us remember when Grandma Watkins and the Armour Boys lived there. He starts Jack Yancey up in business. And Jack Yancey is a drinker. He's a wastrel. He is a joiner. He joins everything in town but the Presbyterian Church. And the money flows. One night, my mother, sobbing and crying, got me out of bed, wrapped me in a blanket, and started up the hill for Grandma's place. Halfway up, she was a small woman, and I was heavy for my age. So halfway up, she sat down on a step to rest. She was sobbing and panting and shaking. I said, oh, Mother, why must we go? She answered, I am afraid. Her fear went through me, too, like a cold wind. I remember the blackness of the night and the haste and the terror. I
and the haste and the terror. And I shall, and as long as I live, I shall never forget those moments when we sat on the strange doorstep in the darkness and were afraid. And then summer came and vacation, and I played in the backyard. One day I was making dolls out of hollyhocks turned upside down and digging little houses for them by digging in the clay bank in the backyard. And I heard a sound from the house that was like a muffled cry. There was a banging of an upstairs door, and someone was grinding the crank on the side of the telephone. And I heard Aunt Chadwick's voice calling for the doctor. I kept slowly dropping the red and pink hollyhock ladies one by one as I walked to the house. Aunt Chadwick met me at the back door. Her face was white and her eyes looked strange. "Run for your grandmother," she said. "Run as fast as you can. Your mama's taken some of the wrong kind of medicine, and she's very sick. Go quickly." But none of the small-town methods of that day could save my mother, and yet it took her 2 days to die. And on the nightstand beside my mother's bed, there was an empty medicine bottle and a hastily scrawled note on a scrap of paper. The note did not tell us why she had done what she had done. It did not speak to those of us who were left with love or concern for our future. All it said was, "Carve Abby McBain on my headstone." And so the Yanceys went out of our lives, and it was soon apparent that there was nothing left of my father's small fortune but the house and its furnishings and the money that Douglas had invested for me. So Douglas comes and takes them back to Manitou City to live with him. And there follows a few years of great happiness again. There are new clothes and a good school and a little pony and a cart and a new bicycle and new friends for Christine. And of course, Connie is just in the seventh heaven of delight. She's always been in love with Douglas. And Douglas prospers, the Coeur d'Alene mines are coming in, and Manitou City is just booming. And Jack is, Douglas is making a fortune. Part of it is due to his own good business sense, but some of it is due to his wonderful secretary, Molly. Now, every businessman should have a Molly. She is not the kind of a secretary that sits on the laps for dictation, but she was the kind with the big, thick glasses that balanced the budgets, filed the letters, and knew who should get in to see her boss and who shouldn't. And she, too, is in love with Douglas. But when she sees it's hopeless, she says, "Well, Douglas, I know that I was not the pretty one, but I do have a very, very beautiful sister who was smart, too. She married her aged boss, and he died and left her a great fortune. You must meet Sheila." And beautiful women have always been Douglas's weakness. So he meets Sheila, and then follows 2 years of a wonderful platonic friendship. Finally, they decide to just make it legal and get married and lead a good life. Well, Connie and Grandma and Christine go back to Moscow. And Sheila and Douglas move in to a beautiful pink champagne apartment. And the day of the wedding reception, among the caterers and the pâté de foie gras and the champagne, comes a lovely big 2-bushel basket of hand-scrubbed potatoes from the Big Bend country, where Douglas has started Willie up on a small sheep ranch. Sheila is humiliated and orders them taken out and given to the serving girls. Now, Sheila is a social climber, and the finest status symbol is a cottage on the lakes. Her millionaire friends, the Beaches, have one out there, and they call it the Ark. So she and Douglas must build one right beside it, and theirs will be more lavish and more extravagant still, and theirs will be called the Imp. So to Lake Vivienne they go, and it's a palatial place that they build. It's all furnished with lovely black lacquer imported furniture, and it's hung with heavy scarlet velvet draperies. And then on the fireplace and in all the windows and every nook and crevice is a little sophisticated note, a hand-carved red devil leering down upon them. It's a new motor car for them. And then the fastest motor launch on the whole lake, and it too is called the Imp. And another status symbol is a trip to Europe. And Sheila has some shanty Irish relatives there who keep the pig in the parlor. And Douglas would love to go back to the old croft and see the aged father and the family that are left. But he remembers how that peat fire smoke and the half-empty rain barrel, and how their outdoor toilet was just a corner of the barn. And he doesn't want Sheila to see these things. So when they get as far as Dublin, they separate. But Douglas, when he returns to Caithness, finds such great contentment and such peace of mind. And he seems so to belong as he sits around the peat fire in that little family circle. And he does a lot of soul searching. And he cries out, as all men sometime will cry out, "Oh, what shall it profiteth it a man if he gaineth the whole world but loseth his own soul?" After 3 days, Sheila's had enough. It's on to Paris and Rome. And they spend too much, they drink too much, they travel too far and too fast, and they buy works of art and statuary, diamonds. And on the trip home, Douglas has a moment of truth in the black of night on board that ship, and he knows that he has overspent and overexpanded. Beside my mother's bed, there was an empty... Well, Molly knows it too. And then the drop of water that starts the avalanche fell. One morning on the streetcar, the conductor, who had money invested in Douglas's